Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and joined as always by Frank Cagliano. How are you doing, Frank?
Hi, David. I'm doing great, thank you.
Before we dive in with the main topic for the show, do you want to make a programming announcement?
Yes. So, unfortunately, due to events beyond our control, tonight's live episode at the Edinburgh History Festival has had to be canceled. So we will. We are hoping to. Well, let's say postpone because they want us to come back next year.
Yes,
it's an annual festival, so you'll have to wait a year. So, we apologize to people who are planning to attend.
Right. Okay. So last week there was a unscheduled visit by President Trump to the hospital, which was advertised. It was reported as a routine part of his checkup that they were having early for scheduling reasons. Which immediately led to some supposition that maybe there was some more complicated medical things going on. Frank, what was your reaction when you first saw the news that Trump was making an unscheduled visit to the hospital?
Well, my first reaction was he's, 72 years old? Or
something like that,
yeah. 73, he's in his early, he's the oldest man ever to serve as president. He, despite his claims to the contrary, is not terribly fit. And therefore, I wasn't entirely surprised. And I think that with a man of his age and level of fitness, health has to be a concern.
Mm.
I think that we were clearly being misled, and we can talk about whether that's appropriate or not, by the White House when they said they claimed that this was a, he was going to do some of the tests for his physical. The physical, I think, is in February annually.
Usually, yes.
That didn't see it because he had free space in his schedule. Well, the president shouldn't have much free space in his schedule.
He has for golf, so
he does,
know, which is his next form of extra anyway.
Executive time. Anyway, so let's just say I was skeptical.
As was I.
And this prompted us to think about the history of presidential health. And as we've been discussed this off air, what became clear to us is this is actually a more complicated question than it seems. Because on one hand, perhaps the visceral response to somebody who's critical of the Trump administration, as I think we both are, is, oh, they shouldn't lie about that. This is one more thing they lie about, or they lied about. And I think that's, I think the fact is true that they probably misled the public about it. Whether the public needs to know about presidential health or how much the public needs to know is where things get, I think, interesting and complicated, which is one of the things we want to talk about today.
Right. Yeah, it turns out that actually, there's a long history of presidential health issues being disguised from the public. So this is actually, assuming that Trump wasn't merely going for part of his checkup, this is part of a long trajectory of those things. There's an interesting episode with Washington where there's some a very slight medical cover-up, which is more amusing than anything else. Frank, do you want to tell that story?
Sure. I mean, the one thing I will say about George Washington is he suffered from ill health late in life, particularly, the story that's often told is about him, having wooden teeth. And Washington had very, very poor teeth. By the time he was he was president, he likely only had one tooth left of his own. So he had all kinds of alternatives, many of which were unsatisfying for dentures. And he was in a lot of pain. So when you see the paintings from Washington's presidency and he looks rather grim.
It's probably because he was in a lot of pain.
He's in pain and can't smile.
Yeah.
And part of Washington's image was this kind of his unapproachability and his distance from people. But again, he's in a lot of pain. Mm. He's in constant pain. And I think we have to bear that in mind. With regard to the incident you're referring to, during his presidency, Washington had a boil lanced. His doctor reported it was on his thigh. Well, it was on his upper thigh, because this boil was on his butt.
That was not appropriately presidential.
No, and it didn't kind of comport with, presidential dignity and Washington's sense of dignity. And so the doctor... His doctor, when reporting this and reported treating this, claimed that this was on his thigh.
Mm.
And I think, slightly amusing, although not for President Washington, undoubtedly. It must have been very painful.
Yes.
while slightly amusing, it goes to the some of the big themes we want to talk about today, I think, which is presidents and their right to privacy when it comes to health. So I want to, does the public need to know? Did the public need to know in 1790, whenever, that Washington had a boil on his bottom? Probably not, yeah. I would say. I mean, does anybody need to know that?
Well, it's very hard to ride a horse if you...
I would imagine, yeah. But I think it's actually a more complicated question than I realized when we started thinking about and researching this episode.
So, to be sure. All right.
So, we had a couple of guys in your period in particular die in office.
Yeah, so William Henry Harrison dies a month after taking office, and the way they understood it at the time was that basically he gave a three-hour inauguration speech in the cold and didn't wear a hat and got pneumonia. Which probably contributed to it, but he was also very elderly, so that he died pretty quickly. Zachary Taylor died in 1850. This was in the aftermath. He had gone to a 4th of July picnic to raise money for the Washington Monument, which was then under construction. Supposedly he ate a lot of raw fruit and ice milk, and that some people attribute it to the raw fruit and or ice milk.
Raw fruit is fresh fruit.
Well, yes, but there was a sense that maybe it could have been contaminated with some kind of cholera or that kinds of things. You know, various kinds of pathogens one can get from raw fruit.
How soon did he die after?
Well, he died. He got very sick very shortly thereafter, as did several members of his cabinet. And you know, there's been hypotheses that maybe he was poisoned. People have thought that he probably was actually mostly just because the White House was downstream from a bunch of sewage, and so the odds are it's probably just bad water that he was drinking. The Washington in the 1840s and 1850s wasn't the healthiest place. It was kind of an open sewer and a swamp. So talking about draining the swamp, they really needed to drain the swamp in the mid 19th century, because people went to Washington and got very sick just because of the where that city's located on the Potomac and the ways in which the water for the city was collected. So he dies, but you know, after a fairly brief illness. In terms of cover-ups, though, the really interesting one from the 19th century is Grover Cleveland, who is not a president many people remember. If they remember him for anything, it's because he's the one guy who served these two non-consecutive terms. But he had a really interesting health cover-up in 1893. Frank, do you want to...
Yeah, so Cleveland in 1893, this is an interesting case, David. He discovered a lesion, or he developed a lesion in his mouth, and his doctor took a look at it and thought it was cancer.
Yes, and this is, you know, when cancer was basically untreatable for all intents and purposes.
That's
and
right.
Seen as sort of a death sentence.
And in 1893, as some of our listeners will know, the United States was experiencing an economic panic. As it was called, and the economy was in very poor shape and was kind of tethering, as it were.
Yeah. So I mean, it had gone right from a boom to just about to collapse when this health issue gets diagnosed.
And, that's right, and
they called them panics in the 19th century for a reason. You know, this is the Great Depression before the Great Depression.
That's right, and it was arguably the worst one in the 19th century.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Of the ones, you know, as the people's sort of investment in the market economy, when industrial economy gets more robust. You know, widespread unemployment, people, you know, homelessness wandering in the streets, and so...
And industrial violence.
To be sure, you know,
railroads... So imagine for a minute, to give a more contemporary example, you know, that this were occurring during the 2008 crisis.
Yes, right.
That the president, that the then President Bush had been discovered with cancer.
To be sure.
So the worry among Cleveland staff and administration and his carers was that... if this story got out and his treatment got out, or the fact he was being treated for this got out, that it would make the situation worse.
Yeah.
And so Cleveland was meant to go on vacation, he was meant to go on holiday, and so he got on a yacht from New York to Cape Cod, ostensibly, and he spent 4 days there, and they performed surgery on him, removing a significant number of his teeth and half of his jaw.
Yeah, it was five teeth and half of his jaw and his palate.
Right, so this is major surgery under any circumstances, let alone in the late 19th century on a yacht.
They're on a moving boat, and they did it in like 90 minutes, and this is surgery that today takes like 4 or 5 hours. So they're doing sort of radical surgery on the president on a boat.
In secret. And it was later reported that he had a toothache. Well, yes. I bet he did.
Exactly. And we only learned about it 25 years later after basically everybody involved had died.
His doctor wrote an article.
In the Atlantic, I think. And so, you know, in that case, part of me wonders whether Cleveland did the right thing.
Well,
or at least Cleveland's. Was it fair to the American people to sort of cover that up and consciously lie about it?
Well, he didn't run for president again, did he, after this?
No, but he didn't run for president again because the economy really did collapse. Yes. and he got the blame for it, and you know, then you end up with the 1896 election that everyone knows about.
But he finished his term. He does not seem to have been... Well, his travails were not caused by his health.
Yes.
So, and the impulse for secrecy initially, I think, is understandable in the sense that they didn't want to make this the economic crisis worse. And I do think there is an interesting... This wasn't a factor necessarily in Cleveland's case, but it's something we should consider in thinking about this. You know, people have a right to privacy where their medical treatment's concerned. Or you and I do.
Yes.
We have to question as we think about some of these figures we're going to go through chronologically and look at a number of notable examples in the next few minutes. You know, how much privacy does a president give up in this particular area? It's not an easy question to answer. And so, assuming that Cleveland was not, or Cleveland's presidency was not impacted by this beyond the 4 days he was at sea.
Although it probably was. If you have half your jaw removed, that's probably not going to be a four-day recovery.
People, I mean, this is not my period, but people must have noticed. It's toothache in the beginning. You can say, I've got a toothache, but when you can't...
The presidents weren't as public figures in the same way in the 19th century, so you could make an appearance, do the wave thing. He had a big beard or a big mustache that may have covered up some of the disfigurement, if there was any. He was in pretty bad health for both of his terms. He was overweight. He was a chronic smoker and alcoholic. He drank very heavily. He had a myriad of health problems. This is obviously the most critical of them, but he had a bunch of others.
Yeah, I mean, 19th century presidents and politicians did not lead healthy lives.
And in fact, considering they had really good health care compared to most population, most people had pretty miserable lives with all kinds of diseases.
Did he chew tobacco? I mean, was that what caused this?
I think he smoked cigars and he drank heavily, so I don't know.
Right, interesting. So if we go forward a couple of decades, David, we get to probably one of the most famous cases, which is Woodrow Wilson in 1919. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, so Woodrow, just to sort of give some context to this, Woodrow Wilson had gone to Paris for the Versailles Treaty to end the First World War. He'd spent a long time there. He'd come back. He had been going on a nationwide tour to try to promote the League of Nations. And it's while he's on this tour that he has, we think now, a series of strokes, but one big one that leads to him being partially paralyzed and being bedridden for the last 2 years of his presidency, last year and a half of his presidency. And what we think, what many historians think, is that his wife Edith is actually doing much of the sort of policy decisions for him. He's obviously not physically able to do many things, and Edith and his doctor, Dr. Carrie Grayson, seems to have been working together to try to hide his the degree to which he was incapacitated by this stroke.
Now, there was no 25th Amendment then. The 25th Amendment isn't ratified until 1967. And so the Constitution really talks about the death of the president.
Or the inability to perform his office.
It would seem Wilson was... That would apply to Wilson, the inability to perform his office. But that had been untested because previously every presidential succession, apart from elections, of course, had been because of death in office.
Yeah.
And so this was a relatively this was an unprecedented situation. And Edith Galt Wilson, his wife, worked around that seemingly in his name. It seems to me this is an interesting one because this was a prolonged health problem that was kept from the public. And this does seem to me to be inappropriate behavior.
I think
on behalf of his doctor
In democracy, the people should know who they're being ruled by.
Right.
Yeah.
So this isn't a boil on his butt.
No, this is this is a much more significant.
And it's also prolonged. It's a year and a half. It's the last year and a half of his term.
Right. You know, and in large part, you know, it undermined his political agenda, you know, in terms of actually ratifying, you know, if he's interested in getting the League of Nations, you know, the United States join the League of Nations, he obviously can't go campaign for it because he's in bed the entire time. So it actually backfires on him in multiple senses. If he had somebody else take over as president, you know, make that health crisis known, that he might have actually been able to achieve that.
And the failure of the League of Nations is one of the things that contributes to the coming of the Second World War. Now, I'm not suggesting Wilson's stroke caused the Second World War, but there were important matters at stake, yes, during that period.
So thinking about the Second World War, I mean, obviously we think of FDR, who has all kinds of health issues. You know, he contracts polio in 1921 at the age of 39, and spends the rest of his life in a wheelchair, which is a fact that was disguised from the American public throughout that period. That, you know, and something that FDR took great pains to hide from the public. You know, when he gave speeches in public, he used canes to give the appearance that he could walk, but that was mostly just sort of using very heavy leg braces to make his legs sort of stiff as a board, and then using his very strong upper body to sort of pivot his legs into position. So he gave the sort of the appearance of walking on occasion, but he couldn't walk.
Yeah, there was a notable case, I think it was the 1932 convention, when he kind of walks to the podium.
Yes.
And I'm using inverted commas for walk.
Yes, he had conquered polio, you know, that was sort of the narrative that they were pitching. And of course, it was a fiction, and he spends both pre-presidency and presidency in a wheelchair, which there were very few photos. There's lots of photos of him seated, but there's very few photos of him in his wheelchair. There's one famous one, I think, with his niece or something and a dog. Was that appropriate to hide from the American public?
Well, that's a good one. I mean, his polio was not hidden from the public in the sense that it was well known that he had been afflicted by polio and that he had recovered from it. And polio is not debilitating mentally.
Right.
So this was more about image management,
yes,
which to some extent all presidents do.
To be sure.
You know, all presidents are made to look healthier than they are when they're especially when they're campaigning.
Mm.
So it would seem to me that this is... that the FDR case, although there's a wrinkle to it at the end that's important, the FDR case is not necessarily a case of deception. Well, there's an element of deception to it, but his condition was known.
Yes.
It was how it was presented to the public was deceptive.
Mm.
But as I said, all presidents, at least in an era, once the mass media emerges, try to manage how they appear in public.
But there was a huge stigma attached to being handicapped in the early part of the 20th century.
Sure.
And so I think, you know, lots of Americans wouldn't have had confidence in his ability to govern if they realized he couldn't walk.
That's true. I will say a couple things in response to that. One is, who knows what would have happened to that stigma, because FDR was so popular for a long period of time, if he had been out, as it were, as disabled. Maybe that would have helped change that image. Yeah. The second corollary, I'd say, is a personal one, which is my mother-in-law had polio.
Mm.
She was Swedish. She was not American. Loved FDR. Absolutely loved FDR as a figure with polio who was able to succeed. So, I mean, obviously, she was considerably younger than FDR, and this was, you know, this was her view in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. But FDR's importance to her as somebody with the same affliction and the same and similar disabilities is quite interesting. So I just offer that as a personal... FDR's case gets trickier at the end of his life, because when he runs for his fourth term in 1944, his doctor had basically concluded that there was no way he would survive his term. Right. And indeed, FDR dies only a few months into his fourth term.
And of course, this is in the midst of the Second World War, and when there's lots of important things going on.
Right. And... now, you could make the same argument for FDR, given the importance of his leadership, that we suggest implied for Cleveland, that in the crisis, maybe it was better people didn't know. But on the other hand, given the stakes in 1944, the public probably did need to know that he was in you know, it wasn't just the polio with this.
Yes.
He was an old man, and yeah. he was in deteriorating health, and he died a few months after, not a few weeks after taking mm-hmm. the oath of office in 1945.
To be sure.
And
but, you know, with the degree to which Truman was then ill prepared to take over the presidency because he wasn't expecting to, you know, wasn't informed both of both, you know, things like the atomic bomb, but also not informed of FDR's health status.
That's right. So I think, I guess I would say the FDR case is a complicated one because I think there's the polio, but I'm not sure the polio is the issue that his later ill health would be, and it would seem to me that the public, in order to make an informed choice in 1944, should probably have known that.
Yes, that's probably, yes, that's.
So I'd make a distinction between
those two. The polio thing came up in his use of a wheelchair came up when they dedicated the FDR Memorial in D.C., which has segments for each of his four terms, but it has statues of him, and one of the statues is of him in a wheelchair. And you know, there was a debate at the time about whether that was what FDR would have wanted, because he was so careful not to be shown in a wheelchair in public. You know, and disability rights advocates said, no, actually, it's very important to us that we have this representation of a person in the highest political office who, you know, lived most of his adult life in a wheelchair, showing that to the public in this way.
Well, I'd agree with that, and I'd kind of cite the example of my mother-in-law, which I just mentioned. So I think if there's one thing we know about politicians and presidents, they can't control their posthumous legacies, and to some extent, monuments, and we've discussed monuments in a variety of iterations in the course of this podcast, monuments are always about the time they were put up, and so to that extent, I think it's appropriate that he's in his wheelchair, not least because that was core to what was his experience as president. Right. Yeah. We know that. We can't unknow that.
To be sure.
So anyway, I think the FDR case is an interesting one.
What about Eisenhower? Eisenhower, you know, was also like Trump, not a young man when he takes office, and has myriad health problems. How do we unpack Eisenhower's issues?
Eisenhower is interesting because on one hand, he was, as you're right, he was fairly old when he became president. But his image was that of a soldier and a kind of healthy, robust man. He had a heart attack in 1955. He was diagnosed with Crohn's disease in 1956.
And he had major surgery for that.
Yes, and he had a stroke in 1957. So Eisenhower's two terms, particularly his second term, were plagued by ill health, and the heart attack was particularly controversial because that was kept from the public for a while.
And doctors discouraged him from running for a second term.
Yes, that's right.
He ignored them.
And he ignored them and ran for a second term. So Eisenhower's case is an interesting one. I guess what could be said in his favor was it didn't seem to impair these afflictions and maladies didn't seem to impair his ability to do his job. But whether, as we talk this through, David, what's occurring to me is I think the public has a right to know when the public has to make a choice at the ballot box. Maybe that's the... I don't think we need to know, to go back to Grover Cleveland, in the immediate moment of crisis, both because when people are going through a health crisis, they have a lot to deal with, and there should be some scope for that. But if it's a long-term chronic thing that's going to impact somebody, and the public is going to express a choice at the ballot box, they would need to know that. So the public probably should have known more about Eisenhower's health after the 55 heart attack because it had to make a choice in 1956.
Okay.
But when it comes to the day-to-day management of somebody's health, I think within reason, we should try and protect the privacy of public figures.
And then how does that work with Wilson's case?
Oh, well, yeah, Wilson's a good one. Look, Wilson was clearly impaired and should probably have turned things over to his vice president.
Yeah.
I mean, the 25th Amendment makes that much easier. But I think the Constitution as written, as it applied in 1990, you know, Wilson...
Sure.
I guess people do recover from strokes. So
that's true.
I mean, one can imagine that with the best of intentions, Edith Wilson And Wilson's doctor thought, okay, we'll just get him through this and see how he fares. And then once you've been doing this for a little while, it's very hard to stop.
Stop.
So you can see, you know, there wouldn't be
Okay.
nefarious
Yeah,
necessarily.
sure. I mean, one of the things that's different, I think, when you get to the mid 20th century is that the pace in which political crises and global crises can emerge is so much faster than it was in even in Wilson's day and definitely in the 19th century, right? Grover Cleveland being out of commission for 4 days when he's on a boat, like
Who'd miss him?
it doesn't I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but it doesn't matter, right? Like, there's nothing that's going to happen that's going to require the president's immediate attention that can't be put off for 4 days. And by the time you get to, the Cold War, in which, an attack could be launched that could end humanity as we know it in a 15-minute window, a health crisis, if it takes a person out of commission even for a short period of time, can have devastating consequences. Or if it impairs their judgment for a period of time, or they can't devote their full attention to whatever it is. And I think that sort of speaks to, like, why they end up with the 25th Amendment in 1967, is to sort of create, and Eisenhower's illness, I think, contributed to this in terms of Congress feeling the need to have structures in place so that when the president is having surgery, the vice president can take over. Or if the president is incapacitated in other ways, whether it's temporarily or permanently, that he can be replaced. So that there's always somebody who has their hand on the tiller, because the potential damage for letting the boat float adrift, to continue the metaphor, is so much more devastating now than it would have been in the 19th century.
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. And we have a few examples of more recent presidents where this may have been an issue. I mean, JFK, it's
Yeah.
ironic. JFK is always seen as the picture of health.
Sure. I mean, he's the youngest guy ever elected to the office. He's always
And
playing
he's
football, and he's
young and glamorous looking and everything else. He's not very healthy. I mean,
no.
he has chronic back pain. He likely had Addison's disease.
He's
But because of the back pain, he was taking painkillers. His doctor
yeah.
was called Dr. Feelgood.
Good, yeah. And he had all kinds of illnesses as a kid. He'd had diphtheria, he had asthma. So he looked really healthy, and he sort of gave off this patina of youth and vigor, and they sold that, as part of his campaign.
Yes, in contrast to Nixon.
Yes.
But Nixon was probably much healthier than
Healthy.
JFK. He certainly,
That, to be sure.
Lived to a ripe old
Well,
age.
there were other things and factors involved with JFK,
Well,
but
no, I'm talking
yes,
about Nixon. Nixon
Nixon,
lived a long time.
sure. And I think
Yes,
Kennedy,
being shot is
he's
not good
out
for a
president,
president.
that's, but Kennedy was, throughout his presidency, I think, in quite bad health, and disguised that. I think that's one of those places where I think I definitely agree with you. Did it contribute to him making different choices than he would have made had he been healthy? I don't see any evidence of that. And I don't think any particular reason why the public would have needed to know about his back pain or his Addison's disease.
And I guess this is he's a good example of what we were talking about with regard to FDR, which is, well, he was projecting an image for the public, and that was effective. The fact that he wasn't quite as healthy as he appeared, does that matter? Well, it could. And so, the pain medication is an interesting
Yeah, because
topic.
potentially that can
It can
compromise your judgment and your ability to perform your duties.
exactly. On the other hand, the great crisis of his presidency, the kind of international crisis you were talking about, was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there's no evidence to suggest that he, his judgment or his actions during that period, I mean, we can critique them, but that his health necessarily played a role in that, in those.
As far as we can
As
tell.
far as we know,
Yeah.
of course, as far as we know.
I mean, there may be other health crises that that we don't know about the presidents have had. These are the ones we're talking about, the ones we know about.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, that's right. And then more recently, you get Reagan, and I think Reagan's an interesting case because you know, we know he died from Alzheimer's and the complications arising from Alzheimer's disease. The kind of accepted view of his biography is that he developed Alzheimer's 5 years after the presidency. But his son, Ron Reagan Jr., claimed that he's noticed signs in his father during his presidency.
As did lots of people who watch on TV.
Yeah, yes, that's right. But in terms of, we're just sticking to the known facts. It's and certainly Reagan seems to have taken his hand off the tiller of state in his second term in a way that he, you know, by comparison with his first term.
Yes, that's
at that point was the oldest man to serve as president. We're in new territory. We'll get here soon with Trump and the current crop of candidates. So it would seem to me for something like that where it's chronic and there is no cure, that's a more serious issue.
Okay.
And that the public would have a right to know that.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, I think because that does actually compromise his judgment, his ability to have commanded the fact. And, you know, there's a reading of his final years of the presidency where other people are making all the executive decisions for him.
So it's more like Woodrow Wilson
in some ways, yes. Unlike Wilson, they still had to put Reagan on television because it's not a place, you know. One difference between 1919 and 1987 is the president can't disappear for months at a time. You need to see him on TV every day. And they were able to keep Reagan in the public eye enough, but just not put him in a position where it was visible what his decline was like, assuming that decline was happening.
That's right. So to take some of the examples we've got, Grover Cleveland had a specific malady which seems to have been treated. It was treated in secret so as not to make the economic crisis worse. And he apparently completed his term of office without, as far as we know. We have to qualify everything as far as.
Sure.
That kind of seems like a case where we didn't need to know, or the public didn't need to know. In the case of Reagan, if indeed he did have the early stages of Alzheimer's while he was president of the United States, it seems to me that's something the public needed to know about, and that the government needed to know about so that action could have been taken, because it would have been, it was, for the reasons you intimated earlier, very dangerous for him to be in the nuclear codes under that circumstance.
And one of the things that's happening in the late 20th century, actually, it really, I think it happens in a pronounced way after Watergate, is you have an increased desire by the American public to have transparency about who the president is and what's going on. And so you start to see presidents releasing their medical reports after they have their annual or semi-annual physicals. In the same way that they are releasing their tax returns.
Just about to say that. Yeah.
And the sense that the lesson from Watergate that people took was that the person holding that office may not be the upright statesman they present themselves to be, and so we need independent evidence to verify that the person is healthy and the person isn't stealing money from something, right? Or doesn't have nefarious financials going on. And Trump seems to be undoing both of those post-Watergate standards.
That's right, because he's refused to release his tax return, although we're expecting a court ruling possibly today
he's
refused to release his tax returns, and God knows what's in them, because he's adamant about this. And, you know, the health reports he's released have been risible. So there was the letter from his doctor when he was running for president.
They say he was like the healthiest man he'd ever seen.
Whoever lived.
Yes.
And would be the healthiest president who ever served. And, you know, his doctor, his Navy doctor, who's since left office, who was his, who did personal, his physical last time, personal physician, thank you, you know, again, said he was incredibly healthy. And it beggars belief, and to the point where it really is risible. People laugh when they hear these reports because they don't believe them.
He's not really 6'3 and 239 pounds.
Right, which put him exactly 1 pound below being obese.
Yes, if he had been an inch shorter or a pound heavier.
Right, and he's probably at least an inch shorter, and he's definitely a pound heavier. Yes. So because of that, you're right, Trump has made a mockery of both the transparency, the post-Watergate transparency, both about financial health and physical health. And that's Well, it'll be interesting to see whether we have a reversion to the norm or to the mean, what had become the mean afterwards, or whether this is a new normal. That is one of the reasons, I think, why his trip to the hospital last weekend was treated with such skepticism. I think had he had, if he benefited from more, if he'd been more honest with us, we could have been more honest with him, you know, and I would have said, well, you know, the guy, maybe he had a
chest pains or something,
and therefore he's entitled to go to the hospital. He's a 73-year-old man. He should go to the hospital for chest pain, and we don't necessarily need to know about it unless it's actually going to affect his ability to carry out his job. But because he's been so dishonest with us about everything, it makes it hard to accept that. I think there is a question, apropos of Reagan, about Trump's, and I stipulate that I'm not a medical professional, but about Trump's cognitive abilities. I mean, it seems to me when you see interviews of him, say from the 80s and early 90s, the way he speaks is very different from the way he speaks now.
The size of his vocabulary, his diction, all these things.
Yeah, and you know, describing this phone call is perfect all the time. It's just a strange formulation. So there may be a question, given his age. He's the oldest person. Well, he's not the oldest president yet, but he certainly was the oldest to take the oath of office. And if he finishes two terms, he would be he would certainly be the oldest man ever to serve as president. So he's not a young man, and despite his medical reports, he's not a well man. So I think this is an issue that may well return. But we're also seeing it on the side of the Democrats as they search for a successor or somebody who can take on Trump. So, you know, Bernie Sanders had a heart attack a few weeks ago.
And seemed to bounce back from it pretty quickly.
Yeah, because he had a couple of stents put in and he looks okay, but you know,
or he looks the same as he did before.
Right. Well, yeah, which is to say he looks 78 years old or whatever he is. But, you know, this is, I think as candidates get older, we need to know this. And there was a kerfuffle during the last campaign about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, she was in New York City and she had
for 9/11 commemoration, wasn't it?
And she had the flu and the way they wrote it up is that they thought she had some much more serious heart or health issue that she was covering up.
Right, cause she stumbled a little bit, when they took her away from the ceremony. Now, again, the irony here being that Trump seems to be in worse health than Hillary Clinton now, 3 or 4 years later. But it's all, so I think the public needs to know when in order to make an informed choice at the ballot box.
But how much do we need to know? I mean, the question then is how transparent do public officials need to be about their health? And you know, is it just the president? Is it do we have a right to other public officials when they are being considered by voters or in other ways?
Those are excellent questions, and I'll confess I don't know the answers to them. Except I do think, as you suggested a few minutes ago, the president is different, and the president has the ability, or certainly the power, to kill all of us.
Exactly.
And so we need to know, you know,
or not.
One would argue that's more important than knowing the health of your local state senator or what have
you.
To
be sure.
But do voters need to know? If somebody's running for a 6-year Senate term, you'd want to know whether they were likely to survive that term.
Right. Well, you know, Reagan in 1984 actually, you know, joked about, when he was running for re-election, you know, he wanted, during one of the debates, he said, you know, I'm not going to make age part of the an issue in the campaign. I'm not going to let my opponent's extreme youth and inexperience be held against him.
It's a brilliant line.
Yes, it is. but you know, I think it does speak to the fact that voters do think about these issues, at least on some level, when they consider candidates.
It's interesting because the electorate's getting older, of course.
Well, yes.
And so I find it very interesting that many of the people who want to be the next president of the United States, whether it's Trump continuing in office or Bernie or Biden or
Warren.
Warren is 69 or 70.
I think she's 70.
Yeah. You know, these are septuagenarians. You know, Reagan
or Bloomberg.
Bloomberg 78 is he? So, you know,
the fact that somebody who is 78 said, "I really want a job that's going to start when I'm 79 and will last for 4/8 years. That's a remarkable...
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And that's a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, Reagan was considered very old, and he was 69 when he ran. Right. So he was actually younger than everybody we've just mentioned.
Yes.
Which is remarkable. So what we've seen is, although... You know, there are more young people than ever before. The population's growing. In the political class, that's not necessarily the case. Now, whether this is a trend or not remains to be seen. Obama was very young, and there were echoes of JFK when Obama was elected. Sure. You know, back in 2008. So, I don't know where this is going. And as for what we need to know, how much we need to know is an interesting question. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that after this particular moment. Depends on how long a moment is.
Exactly.
But after the Trump period, I have a feeling there'll be a turn to greater transparency again, as there was post Watergate, both financial and physical. Mm-hmm. And so we'll probably know more in the future. Yeah. But I do think, as I said to begin with, this is less straightforward than I thought. Once I began working through some of the issues, I do think that, to the extent it's possible, that politicians, like everybody else, deserve a measure of privacy.
Because you can imagine some very qualified people who would make very good public servants choosing not to run if they felt like they had to disclose health issues they didn't want to disclose, but felt compelled to.
Yes.
You know, so I can think of any number of medical situations like that where they, you know, that would they would feel prohibited from running when the public would benefit from their service. So that's a potential danger to the whole thing. You mentioned in joking the line from Trump's doctor that he thought he was going to be the healthiest president ever. Who do you think was the healthiest president ever?
Oh, that's a good question.
We've talked about all these guys who had all these issues. Who are somebody who
Jimmy Carter's lived a good long time. Yes. So it might be Jimmy Carter.
He's now the oldest living ex-president.
Yeah, that's
Hoover
right.
Hoover lived for a very long time.
Hoover lived for a long time. Theodore Roosevelt was pretty... He was robust. But, you know, if you've led an active life, you kind of break down late in life.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of what happened to T.R. And also happened to Andrew Jackson, who was a robust... Got shot. He had a bullet in him. My boy T.J.'s pretty healthy until the end of his life when he suffers all kinds of ailments. He's a little bit of a... little bit of a hypochondriac and suffers from migraines, but you know, he had a low meat diet. He basically said we should eat, he would take the modern diet and reverse it. So vegetables should be your mains and you should use meat as a garnish.
Okay.
And so, you know, so Jefferson was reasonably healthy. John Quincy Adams famously lived a good long time and famously swam in the Potomac naked.
There's image listeners in your mind.
And he was pretty healthy. His father, John Adams, was pretty healthy. Lived to his early 90s, I think.
That sounds right.
Who do you think is the healthiest?
I've got two candidates. Rutherford B. Hayes.
Okay. Never gets enough attention.
Yeah. Well, Rutherford B. Hayes, he was you know, a Civil War veteran, but he was in, you know, so very good physical health. He didn't drink, he didn't smoke, he ate a healthy diet by the late 19th century standards of a healthy diet. So, you know, he had a fairly sedate lifestyle but exercised regularly and seemed to not have any health issues. And I'd put Obama in there as somebody who was quite healthy. I mean, the thing Obama
very
did,
good athlete.
He smoked. But he also had the White House garden where they're growing all those organic vegetables all the time and are serving those at state dinners.
Although smoking is...
Yeah, I'm not... Yeah, the question about how much he was smoking.
Right,
he was smoking
because he's
some.
A sneaky smoker.
Exactly. That's another health issue that he was hiding in a way.
Yeah. Although he didn't hide it terribly well because it was reported.
Well, yes. But you didn't see pictures of him smoking.
But he was... He's a basketball player and a good basketball player by reports. And seems to have been pretty fit and worked out. Obama was pretty healthy. Yeah, okay. But of course, Obama was young as well when we met him, or younger than the norm. But yeah, I could see that. But it has to be Jimmy Carter. I feel like we're getting into analytics.
Yes.
He's lived the longest.
To be sure, yeah.
so well, that's going to count for something.
It's been interesting thinking about this versus Trump in the news recently, because Carter's had, within the past 6 months, a number of both minor and major medical issues as a 90-whatever-year-old man. And at one point, he fell down some stairs. He had a fall, and he's had some other issues. And he's been amazingly transparent about all of those things.
Yes.
You know, so at one point, he showed up for teaching Sunday school and had a big bruise around his eye and whatnot, which I think is a... Well, I think that speaks volumes about the differences between Carter and Trump with regards to certain personal characteristics.
Sure, sure. But as I said, we might want to cut Trump some slack for last Saturday.
Oh, okay.
That, well, that would be that would be the generous. That was that's the most generous I can be. But the fact that we don't is because of what's gone before. Right.
So he has good, unlike some of the other things he's done, he has good precedents for disguising any medical issues he has.
Yeah, and I think an immediate medical issue that isn't interfering with his ability to do his job should be personal and private. Or could be.
That seems a reasonable conclusion to draw.
Yeah. But okay. I think if it's chronic and ongoing and would affect his ability to do his job, then we would need to know about that. I think that's the standard.
Okay.
So
the 25th Amendment.
Don't need to know if George Washington has a boil on his butt, but we do need to know that Woodrow Wilson had a stroke.
I'm kind of glad we do know that now.
Well, it's
because it leads to a funny story. But for you know, fourth graders.
Yes, exactly. Anyway,
you got a last drop?
I do. I want to give a shout out to historians. So if you've been watching the impeachment hearings, you'll know that two of the most the most impactful performers, if that's the way to put it, or most effective, were Marie Yovanovitch last Friday and Fiona Hill yesterday. Marie Yovanovitch was an undergraduate history major. And Fiona Hill has a doctorate in history.
Oh.
So shout out to the historians and the women.
Exactly.
because they've been the two of the most important, and we'll undoubtedly talk about the impeachment again in coming weeks. So I just want to, history prepares you for life.
History does prepare you for life and congressional testimony and all kinds of things.
What about you, David?
Well, I think as many listeners know, or if you don't know, there's going to be a strike starting next Monday, assuming things don't change in the next, between when we record this and when you listen to this. The UCU, the union of which both Frank and I are members, are going on strike. And I just saw this before I came up to see Frank to record this episode. Our local branch of the UCU has recorded their own podcast explaining why we're going on strike, which I've not had a chance to listen to yet, but I'm looking forward to that, and so you may want to listen to that as well to understand the industrial action we're about to take place.
We haven't discussed this yet, but we will continue to record the podcast because this is not not work.
It's not. This is play.
But we will be recording it off campus. But
to be sure. Right.
Excellent. Cheers. Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.